Good evening, everybody. My name is Magdalena, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Magdalena!
I'd like to thank Richard for asking me to speak. That was very nice. He's a man of few words. So he just said, would you like to speak? And he gave me the details, and then I didn't hear anything from him for about a month. So I'm like, oh, I wonder if he still wants me to speak. But anyways, thanks, Richard. And he also picked me up from the airport, and Sharon has housed me over the weekend. She's been great. She fed me breakfast and dinner last night, so thanks a lot. And it's been so great meeting Leah this weekend and everybody and, you know, the speakers. Al, that was wonderful. Thanks for your story. And where's Mr. Oh, okay. Well, thanks, Mr. Talk-A-Lot. He talks a lot, Charlie. He's been wonderful. Thanks. Well, what it was like, what happened, and how it is today. I like to share from the beginning, and this is only, you know, how I just speak. I am from Mexico, Ensenada, Baja California. Randy has been there. Yay, Randy. And it's right on the beach. It's a drinking town. Everybody drinks, you know, gets involved in drugs and whatever. And my father is the first alcoholic that I met. He started drinking with his father when he was 8 years old. So by the time my parents met, he was already an alcoholic. They were about 15, 16 years old. And so, you know, alcoholism was from the beginning in my life. My father started drinking with his father when he was a little boy. And so, you know, it was, I am the first daughter of six sisters. And my father always wanted a boy. And so when I was born, you know, he said, he named me after his father. His father was named Magdaleno. And so I was named Magdalena. And I asked my mom, I go, how come nobody ever talks about my grandfather? You know, everybody talks about everybody else, but except my grandfather. And I want to know more about him. I was named after him. And she said, well, they don't talk about him because he was crazy. And I said, oh, okay, so what was wrong with him? And she said, well, he drank a lot. And I'm like, oh, okay. So the story goes that they didn't know what to do with my grandfather on those days, and they didn't know what to do with alcoholics who were crazy. So what they did, they built a box in the back, very backyard, you know, and they stuck him in there. And they had a little door like this big, and they used to feed him food, you know, until he died. And so he didn't have any friends, and my father was his only friend. So he started drinking with his father when he was 8 years old. So when, you know, I thought drinking was normal. My father drank every single day, ever since I remember. And my mom, you know, my father is about 5 foot, you know, 5'2", 5'4", really short. And my mom is 5'11", like I am, very tall, very beautiful. And my dad has got this, he has this big belly, you know. He's got this big, round, ugly face. And I thought, what is she doing with him? He's so ugly. And he was always drunk. But my mom kept having kids. You know, she kept having kids. And I'm like, oh my God, what's wrong with this woman? And every time a child was born, my dad would say, oh, another prostitute, another prostitute. So we grew up thinking that we were prostitutes. And my father didn't believe that women should be educated. So I was not allowed to go to school. And I was told from the beginning, very beginning, that I was stupid. I was, I should be selling food on the streets. Education was not for women, and on and on and on. And so I, you know, in order for me to go to school, I had to sneak out of the house to go to school. And when my dad was not home, so I grew up thinking that I'm stupid, I'm a prostitute, I'm named after a crazy guy. You know, we went to Catholic Church, and Mary Magdalene was supposed to be a bad woman, and I was named after Mary Magdalene, you know, and this crazy guy. So I just grew up thinking I was stupid. I should not even exist in this world. And one day I asked my mom, I said, Mom, what's a prostitute? And she said, well, you know when we go to the bar and wait for your dad for a long time? I'm like, yeah. She said, well, you know those women that are standing outside of the bar? Those are prostitutes. And I thought, my gosh, I'm 6 years old, you know, 6, 7. I don't look like them. But anyways, I grew up thinking that I was a prostitute. And my dad always, he was this violent alcoholic. In the morning, he used to tell me, larguchona, which means this ugly long thing. It doesn't really mean anything. It's just something ugly and long. And I have always been tall and thin, always, always. And my father used to say, larguchona, go get me a bottle of tequila. So 6, 7 years old, you can buy tequila in Mexico. So I used to go to the liquor store, get him his tequila, and come back home, you know. And while I was walking back to the house, I'd be thinking, gosh, you know, he's having tequila. Sometimes he puts soda in it. And all we eat is beans and tortillas. That's all we eat, just beans and tortillas. There's nothing else. So when I would get home, I'd be really angry, and I would tell my dad, well, here's your tequila. And, you know, why are you drinking tequila? And here we are, you know, we're having beans and tortillas every day. And my dad used to get very angry. You know, he would get very angry. And he had this thin little leather belt, you know, very skinny. And he used to just pull it out and hit me with it. And just hit me and hit me. And I remember putting my arms up, you know, so to cover, you know, my face. But I would get belt marks all over my body and go to school like that. And I, like I said, I have always been very tall and thin. And most kids in Mexico are short and chubby. You know, they're cute, they're short and chubby. And here I am, tall and skinny. So I would go to school, and the kids didn't want to play with me. They thought I looked strange, you know, and they called me all kinds of names. And they said, we don't want to play with you. You know, you're strange, and you smell like beans. And I did, because that's all we ate. We didn't even have toothbrushes. And this went on almost every day. And I got into yoga early in life. I became vegetarian. I was 6 years old. I was this wonderful kid exercising and doing good things for myself. I learned young in life that you know, whatever, my body is a temple of my soul. And I'm in the garden. I'm not going to put junk food in my body and things like that. So I started doing yoga, and my dad thought that was witchcraft, so I was not allowed to do yoga either. But I would sneak out of the house and go anyways. And my father, you know, in the mornings when he had hangover, he would also tell me, after I came back from, you know, the liquor store, or while I was in bed, he would say, larguchona, get up and sweep the floor. And then I would look at him and say, why, it's a dirt floor. You know, so he would hit me again. And we lived in this tiny little house. I mean, it's like closer, I mean, smaller than from here to the tree. And at that time, there was 5 kids, and my parents, 7 of us, slept in the little house. And when it rained in the house too, you know. So it was pretty bad. And my dad, he was always dating other women. And I'm like, what are they looking at him? He's so ugly. And his father had left him this long machete. And once in a while, he would feel remorseful. Oh, poor guy. He felt remorseful. And he would pull out this machete, and he would go outside. In the dark, we had no electricity, no water. He would go outside and try to stab himself. And I remember my mom telling me, go see what your dad is doing. And I saw that he was ready to stab himself. And I would go, go ahead, you know, just kill yourself, get it over with, you know. Life would be so much easier without the alcoholic. And you know, today I understand that alcoholism is a family disease. And my father is sick. You know, he's still alive, he's still drinking. I don't know how, but he's still doing it. But today I also understand that God takes care of us. It doesn't matter how bad the situation is, God always takes care of us. And I had these wonderful grandparents that I just adore. My grandparents lived in the prostitution neighborhood. For some reason, they also had a small. They rented a small one bedroom house, and I would go and spend a lot of time with my grandparents. And I remember, you know, going to my grandmother's house and just sitting next to her, and she would be making flour tortillas, and she would give me a tortilla, and I would put butter on it, and I would eat it. And I just felt a love from my grandmother. And sometimes we would go to the coffee shop, and then we would skip to the coffee shop and skip back, you know, to the house. I just adore my grandmother. And I also adore my grandfather. You know, my grandfather was this wonderful guy who, he told me he traveled everywhere. And he, you know, I would be sitting in my grandfather's laps, and he would read books to me and talk to me in Japanese or Chinese. And he was just this wonderful, smart guy, I thought. You know, but while I was sitting in my grandfather's laps, I was helping him clean the seats out of the marijuana. And then I was helping him roll the joints of marijuana, you know. So then my grandfather would light up a joint, and he said, "Here, do you want to take a hit?" And then I said, "Oh, no, Grandpa, I don't want to smoke. That stuff stinks," you know. So watching my father drink and watching my grandfather get high, I have never used drugs or alcohol, so I have never been drunk. I have tasted alcohol, but I have never been drunk in my life. And so, you know, I love my grandfather, and our denial is so thick, that it's hard to see that they're alcoholics or addicts or whatever that is. And I had been in the program for some time before I realized that every time my grandfather was talking to me, he was talking to me in Chinese and Japanese, I think he was high, you know, this whole time he was high. Because today I understand that marijuana makes people lazy. And so I don't think he went anywhere, you know. It was just, and so when I started dating, I didn't want anything to do with alcoholics. But if the person was an addict, oh, they were higher class, you know, I would go out with them. And one day, you know, my dad came to my mom and said, "Well, you know, I'm dating another woman, and she's much younger than you, and she's pregnant, and I don't love you. You need to leave and take your 5 kids with you." And not knowing what to do, my mom started looking for work, and she started looking for work. But who's going to hire her? You know, she was about 25 years old. She had 5 kids with a 6th-grade education, no jobs in Mexico. And I remember looking for work with her, and nobody will hire her. And so she decided, she said, "You know, what if I move to the U.S.? Can you take care of your sisters?" And I said, "Well, yeah, sure, Mom." I was 15 years old. So I stayed back, and my mom went to the U.S. and started working as a maid. And she started sending money, and now we were eating better. And, you know, and what happened with my father, even though he had a new woman, a younger woman, his alcoholism is a progressive disease. Today I understand that. And today I understand that my dad is sick. And I can't blame him for being sick. He is sick. He's got the disease of alcoholism. And so his alcoholism progressed, and he forgot that we were his daughters. And he started touching my sisters in an inappropriate manner and started spying on me when I was getting undressed. And I started getting scared. I thought, you know, something's going to happen here. Something's happening right now. And so I wrote to my mom and I said, "Mom, this is what's going on." And my mom knew, you know, she knew, because I remember seeing her telling my dad, "Stop, don't do that to the kids." And so I wrote to my mom and I said, this is what's going on. One of my sisters had stopped talking. And I just like, what's wrong with you? Talk to me. And she was not talking. And so my mom said, well, if you want to come and live in the U.S. with me, you have to go to work and you can't go to school. And I said, Mom, that's fine. I had stayed back in third grade 3 times because I just could not learn. I really thought I was stupid. I went to school and I remember grabbing the notebook and trying to read it, and the words would just dance, you know, they would just dance away. Nothing was penetrating this head. When I was at school, I'd be thinking, will I get beat up again today? Am I going to have anything to eat? Is there going to be electricity? Do I have to go steal water from the park? And, you know, stuff like that. And so I didn't learn it. And then the kids would say, well, you're stupid. You look like a dog. And then I will, you know, I had a dog at that time. And I remember looking at the dog and looking at mine, and his lips and my lips kind of look alike, you know. So I started barking in my, you know, I would bark myself in the mirror and say, you are a dog. And then start thinking, you know, those old tapes, you're stupid, you're too skinny, you're blah, 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 and it just goes on and on. And you know, today I understand that, yes, my dad has a disease, he is sick, his alcoholism affected me, but nobody hurt me as much as I have hurt myself. Because nobody told me to bark in the mirror and call me names. Nobody did. I did that. And so I decided to come and live in the United States or in the U.S. And I came like most Mexicans do. I jumped the fence and came to work, you know. And I went to work in a chicken farm. And in this chicken farm, you know, they have rows and rows and rows chickens, and every chicken box, you know, they have about 20 chickens. And under the chicken box, there's a chicken poop. So when immigration came looking for all the Mexicans, the illegal Mexicans, you know, some of them will run up the hills, and other ones we will hide in the chicken poop. And I was one of the ones that I hid in the chicken poop. And I remember sitting there for a long time, just for a long time, and, you know, when you're sitting in that chicken poop, I mean, there's a big pile. and there's worms in there, and there's bugs, and they stick to your skin, and you can't move, you know, you can't move. So I remember when I didn't hear any more noise, I will come out and try to clean myself up. You know, but I don't know if you guys have touched chicken poop, but it sticks to your skin, and it smears, and it smells. I was 15 years old. I had a lot of acne, and I had a lot of poop around me. And I just felt like the rejects of the universe. I just felt so bad. So one day I told my mom, I said, Mom, I have no friends. Can I go to school? And she said, well, yeah, you can go to school, but you can't stop working. And I said, okay, that's fine. So I went to night school, and I wanted to speak English. And that's where I saw the most gorgeous guy in the universe. There he was. You know, he had long hair, beautiful. He had a lot of friends. And wherever he walked, you know, all these people follow him. And when he moved, you know, the whole world moved with him. He was just so gorgeous. And I saw him, and I fell in love with him the first time I saw him. And I thought, you know, he's never going to look at you. You're stupid, you're tall, you're skinny, you're so dark, and blah, blah, blah. I just went on and on. And you know, how do you stop those tapes? How do you stop those tapes? Nothing can help us except, you know, how I understand God today is only the second step, the insanity, what the alcoholic tells us is not true, you know. What I have learned in Al-Anon that, you know, when somebody's saying something negative to us, they're only talking about themselves, because somebody that feels good about themselves, they're not going to tell us, you know, anything negative. So you give what you have, you know, and that's what my father had. So anyways, Al-Anon also, I have learned that, you know, we don't give up that easily, you know. And and I like that guy, you know. So, and our literature also talks about, you know, one day at a time, that anything we let go has our claw marks on it. So I started spying on this guy. I started stalking him, you know. And now I had one friend, and every time this guy went by with his friends, you know, I would start throwing kisses at him, and then I would push my friend so he would think it was her, you know. But sooner or later, he realized it was me. And one day I was at the park with this friend, and there he was with all of his friends, and he called me over, and I went over there, you know. And so after we exchanged names, he said, "Would you like to go to a concert tonight?" And I go, "I wonder what that is." And I said, "Yes." And this is 1975, and Bad Company was playing in San Diego. And I had never heard English music, you know. And I said, "Well, you got to ask my mom." And he said, "Okay." So he sent his friend to ask his mom, my mom. And I thought he was shy. Oh, poor guy, he's shy. He needs a little help, you know, but I can help him. And so he, so my mom said, "Okay, you can go." And so I got in, he came and picked me up. He had this old Nova, and I got to sit right next to him. There was a lot of people in the back seat of the car. I'm like, how do they all fit in there? You know, they were stuck on top of each other. And I got to sit next to him, and he pulls out this 8-track player, you know. And he puts it in the stereo, and this loud music comes out. I'm like, oh my God, this is so exciting. You know, I'm addicted to excitement. And so they started smoking marijuana, and I go, oh, I'm in love, you know. It took me back to my grandfather's labs. And then they pass out the joint in front of me, and then they say, "You want some, you know, a hit?" And then I said, "Oh, no, thank you." You know, I was very proper. But in my head, I thought, "I can roll them for you if you need help," you know. Since I had enough of experience. But because it was our first date, I wasn't going to be pushy, you know. So we dated for 2 years, and I got pregnant, and we got married. You know, we got married. And I thought, you know, during these 2 years that we dated, he tried to kill me a couple of times because he was high on acid. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this guy needs a lot of help, you know. His mom abandoned him in Mexico when he was a little boy, and he grew up on the streets, but now he had me, you know. I was going to love him, and I was going to make sure he stopped drinking, you know. And I truly believe that. It's like, oh, he just needs love, you know. When we get married, we're going to, you know, live in this nice area in San Diego. And it was Rancho Bernardo. And we're going to live there, and then we're going to have two nice low riders park outside. And then we're going to play tennis, you know. And, of course, none of that happened. You know, we got married, and he left me at home with, you know, by myself. And now I was pregnant, and now I was too fat, you know, too dark, you know, too stupid. I thought, how dare you think that this guy was, what made you think, you know, how stupid can you be that somebody like that would love you? You know, nobody loves you. So we had our daughter, and she was just so gorgeous. You know, there she was, this plumpy little girl. You know, she was light complexion. And I like to tell you, you know, when you're in Mexico, you know, the darker you are, the lower class you are. So I was in pretty low class. I got lighter in Washington. And then I had this white, plumpy kid, and she was chubby, and oh, we just felt in love with her, and she was just so beautiful. Then we named her Mirabella, which means look at the beauty. And we looked at it, and we were both happy. And I told her, you know, you are just so gorgeous. I'm going to just love you, and nobody's going to hurt you. I'm going to protect you. You know, you're my daughter. You're part of him and I, you know, the one that I love the most. So alcoholism is a family disease. It's a contagious disease, and it's a progressive disease. And soon I forgot about taking care of my daughter. All my concentration was on what the alcoholic was doing or not doing and how to prevent him from doing whatever he was doing. And I stopped taking care of my daughter. You know, I would, by this time, my sisters were now in the U.S., and I would give my daughter to my sisters for them to take care of him. And I, my husband's alcoholism progressed. He was drinking every single day. He was always in jail. And I was always bailing him out of jail. I started, you know, just going crazy. All my concentration is like, this guy has to love me, you know. He's got to love me. And he will leave the house, and I will get in front of the door and say, don't leave me. And then he will push me and go, you know. So when he came back, I was, like, so angry. I was so angry. But then I would try to retain him, you know. Maybe if I dress sexy, you know, maybe he'll stay. And I would, you know, dress really sexy and wait for him by the window and wait and wait and wait. He will never come home. He just never came home. And by 2, 3, 4 in the morning, he will come home. And I was so angry that I would go grab a knife out of the kitchen, you know, in the kitchen door. And I would grab a knife and just wait for him behind the door, you know, just wait for him. And as soon as he walked in, I would just, you know, I wanted to kill him. I wanted to kill him. And I, you know, we would break mirrors, throw pots and pans. It was bad, and it was loud, and the neighbors used to come out. And for some reason, we always lived with other addicts live, or other alcoholics, and they would come upstairs running. We lived in the second floor, and they would say, Magdalena, stop, stop. And I would be with the knife, you know, and I would say, you know, don't even try to get in between us, because I'm going to kill you too. It was just, I was totally insane. I would talk to my child, and saliva used to come out of my mouth. I, you know, like foam. I had rabies, I guess. I don't know. I was so angry. I couldn't control my anger. And so my husband started shoplifting. He started using heroin, and he started shoplifting, and I started shoplifting with him, because after all, he needed a supportive wife, you know. But you know, nothing worked. He continued to drink it, and I thought, well, maybe if I have a son, you know, this time if I'm gonna have a son, and I'm gonna have a boy, and my mom couldn't have any boys, but I'm gonna have a boy, and he's gonna stop drinking. And I had a boy. I couldn't believe it. I had a boy. And I was just so happy. We were both happy. And I named him after him. And I made that same promise that I made to my daughter, that I was going to protect him and nothing was going to happen to him. But again, you know, I forgot those promises because my concentration was on what he was doing. And I was working in a factory and always working to bail him out of jail. And things got worse. Now I had two kids. And my sisters were not, some of them were gang members involved in very violent activities. My grandfather and my husband were getting high together. My mom had a new boyfriend, and they were selling drugs to my husband. And I was just going crazy. I didn't know what to do. And I thought, you know, once in a while I would get deported to Mexico. And I remember standing by the borderline and looking on both sides to see if there was the border patrol officers. And when I didn't see them, I would just run and run and run to the other side. And when I didn't get caught, I was disappointed. So I would go back and do it over again because I am addicted to excitement. You know, see, I have this that I'm just, like, so active, and I still am. You know, thank God there is places for us in the program, service, you know, service. So when I didn't get arrested again, I would go, okay, it's time to go home anyways. But one time I came with this wonderful idea. I had learned a little bit of English where I could cross the border and tell them that I was a U.S. citizen. And so I told my husband, what if we move to Mexico? You know, you'll be out of jail. You will not be hanging around with your friends. You will not have the problem of drinking, you know. Mm-hmm. He's like, okay, whatever. So we moved to Mexico, and I would cross the border every single day and say that I was a U.S. citizen. And I would drive 120, 160 miles a day just to get my husband away from his friends. But, you know, you guys know what happened. He found new connections, new friends, and there I was again by myself. And I thought, nothing's working. Okay, I'm going to take karate classes, and this time he's going to stop drinking. So I took karate classes, and this was to make me feel peaceful, right? So instead of waiting by the door, I would wait in bed, very peaceful, you know. But as soon as he walked into the bedroom, I would jump out of bed and go, oh! And I just wanted to kill him, you know. And all he wanted to do is go to bed, you know. But the poor guy had to go through me first. And that didn't work, you know. He continued to drink. And one day, the judge told him, you either go to treatment or you go to jail. And he said, I'll go to treatment. And that's when I was introduced to Al-Anon. And I remember I went to my first meeting, and you know, there was a, you know, beautiful people just like you are here today with sparkling eyes, and they all look nice. And this lady asked me, would you like to share? And then I said, I'd like to know if I said, see, I don't know if I belong in Al-Anon because, see, I'm married to an addict and he's not an alcoholic, although he drinks every day, you know. But I don't know if I belong here. And so the lady said, she said, I don't know if you do or not, but, you know, she tapped me on the shoulder and she said, dear, keep coming back. So she didn't give me the answer, you know, and so I didn't come back. I didn't come back for 6 months, and life got worse. And one day I was driving this 120, 160 miles. I don't know how long. I should, check it on Google. But anyways, I was driving this many miles, and my husband got out of treatment, relapse. I didn't go to Al-Anon. Nothing happened. And one day I was driving, and I looked on the side, and there was my husband. He had relapsed. And I didn't know whether he was asleep or he was alive or what, but he was passed out. And you know, during this time, I knew there was no way out of this life. There was just no way out. I couldn't go to church because the God of my understanding had given me, you know, so much poverty, so much pain. I hated him. He didn't love me. I was mad at God. You know, I remember going to church and they would, I would say, well, you know, I hit my sister. My dad hit me, so I hit my sister. And now we're, you know, all angry. And the priest will say, well, get on your knees and pray, blah, 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 blah. And so, but that didn't help me, so I didn't belong in church, you know. I also thought that, you know, maybe there's counselors, but I thought, you know, people like me don't go to counseling. I thought people who went with counselors, they had boogers coming out of their nose and saliva. And I looked in the mirror, there was a lot of things wrong with me, but there was no boogers or saliva coming out of my face, you know. So I thought, you know, I don't belong there either. And I love those kids. I love those kids so much that I just didn't want them to go through the life that I had been to because there was no way out. Everything was dark. It doesn't matter where I went, it was dark, and during that time, you know, the movie The Wall came out with Pink Floyd, and I remember, you know, in the movie, this person kept running to one corner, and there was no way out, and I felt that way. I felt that there was nowhere to go, and so one day I got in the car, and I was driving, you know, and I was driving with those two kids, and I just wanted to die. I was driving over 100 miles an hour, and I said, if there's somebody out there, help me stop because I just want to die. You know, I didn't want my kids to go through that life because there was no way out, you know. But on that day when I was driving and driving back to Mexico, it's like I woke up of a nightmare. You know, for the first time, I looked at, you know, it's like, what am I doing? What have I done? You know, I looked in the back seat of the car and there was the two kids. You know, they were now grown. And those kids had, you know, their hair was in their face. Those kids were so thin. They had the saddest look in their face. And those kids didn't play, you know. They were just there, like existing. And I thought, my gosh, what happened? What happened to the promise that I made to those kids that I was going to take care of them and love them and just protect them? I was hurting them. My husband was not. You know, I took him to a country that it wasn't their country, where there's no water, there's no grass. Those kids were born vegetarian because, I've been vegetarian forever, and there was not enough food for them. There was no milk, nothing. And there was no running water. And, you know, and I thought, my gosh, what have I done? And the upholstery of the car had been teared down, and I had not noticed this, you know. And on that day, I thought, I have run out of ideas. I don't know what to do. I just didn't know what to do. And I remember going to Al-Anon, you know. And I remember the smiling faces, and it was in an Al-Anon club, and there was the steps, the slogans, the traditions, and I remember the slogan, first things first, first things first. So what do I do now? First things first, you know. So I go, oh, I can, you know, take care of my kids. That's what I need to do right now, take care of my kids. And the only thing that said in my mind, you know, that I learned in the first meeting, it was keep coming back and first things first. So I go, I'm invited somewhere. You know, by this time my sisters didn't want to talk to me. I had no friends. In that day, I made the decision to move back to the U.S. and let go of my husband. That was the last thing, you know, let go of my husband. And my husband went back to prison for a long time, and I went back to Al-Anon. And this time, I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. You know, I was ready to do anything the program told me to do, anything. And so I went to that meeting, and I remember sitting in a small group, and I was just so cold. I was so cold. My soul was cold. And it was in a small room where everybody touched each other, you know. And I remember feeling the heat from other people's arms. And that hit warmed up my heart. And for that moment, I would stop shaking. You know, I would stop shaking. And people would say, would you like to share? And I said, I like to, but I can't speak English, because I could understand, but I couldn't speak English. And they said, go ahead and share. And so I would say something, and I started feeling a part of. They asked if they needed a coffee person, and so I volunteered to be the coffee person, because, see, I heard what I heard in Al-Anon is like, you got to get a sponsor, come to meetings, read the literature, do service, and stay in contact. And they said, you got to do service because you can't keep it unless you give it away. And I thought, oh, my God, I got to do something. So I became the coffee person. And on my third meeting, I went out to this guy, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And I asked Ralph, because, you know, when we live in an alcoholic home, as we know, we speak different languages. And you know, the alcoholic is, you know, they're having their language, and it's just, what is he laughing about? What are they laughing about? I just never got the joke, you know. So nobody will listen to me. And so when I would go to a meeting, you know, people would listen. And I remember Ralph, every time somebody shared, Ralph would say, you know, he will not. And he looked at people. And so after the meeting, I went up to Ralph and I said, can you be my sponsor? And see, I couldn't speak English, you know. It was very hard for me to say, can you be my sponsor? And I didn't know Ralph was from England. And he had this heavy English accent. And he looked at me and he said, we'll give it a try. You know, we'll give it a try. But see, Ralph has that unconditional love that we so much talk about. You know, he didn't care how I looked. You know, I was super thin. I had holes in my pants. My face, my hair was like right in, you know, I didn't want anybody to see how shameful I felt full of shame. I stopped going to the hairdresser. My husband, who was drunk, will cut my hair, and I just look horrible. And that's how I came to Al-Anon. And Ralph said, "We'll give it a try." And Ralph and I started getting together 3 times a week. I learned that because my sisters were not drinking or whatever they were doing. They couldn't take care of my kids anymore. I learned that I couldn't trust my kids with an alcoholic. Then my kids used to come home with cigarette burns in their skins, and I thought, my sisters are not doing that. My sisters love my kids. And, you know, but when somebody's not conscious of what's going on around them, they don't know what they're doing. And so, anyway, so I started, Ralph and I started getting together 3 times a week at the park, and I will bring my kids, and the kids will play while Ralph and I got together. And I will, you know, go to step one, step two, step three. And then I will say, Ralph, you know, I'm too skinny. You know, all those steps over and over and over again. And Ralph will say, Magdalena, see that bird up there? And I say, yes, it was a black crow. And I said, what do you think of the bird? I think the bird is beautiful, Ralph. And Ralph will say, do you think the bird gets up in the morning and looks in the mirror and say, you're so black, you're so whatever, your hair's out of place or whatever? I said, no, the bird gets up in the morning and goes and does God's will. He goes and gets food and feeds his kids. Said, you are a child of God, and you are nobody to criticize the children of God. So you can't criticize yourself anymore. You are just the way God intended you to be. So, you know, so you do not criticize yourself. And so I started feeling better about myself. You know, I stopped criticizing myself. I have, like I mentioned, I love running, and I remember going for a run and thinking, you know, oh, that person, you're so slow. You know, I would criticize myself. You're so slow. Look at the person is passing you again. Gosh, can you do anything, right? But now my sponsor told me I couldn't criticize myself anymore. So I would go for a run and sing Pretty Woman Running Down the Street. So my way of thinking started changing, and I started feeling better, and there was no meetings, there was no Al-Anon meetings, so I started Al-Anon meetings. There was no Al-Anon meetings in Spanish, so I started Al-Anon meetings in Spanish, and I just got so busy, I got so busy I forgot about the alcoholic, okay? Now he comes out of prison. It's like, oh gosh, he's home, you know? But the grace, you know, by the grace of God, he decided to go to AA, and now we're both busy. Kids are in Al-Anon, busy family. We bought a home. You know, that happens when we stop out bailing the alcoholic out of jail. There's money, you know. So we bought a home, a trailer, a boat. We were happy. We were happy, involved in service. And it was 1990, and it was the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous in Seattle. And some of our friends were coming, and I told my husband, why can't we go? And he said, well, yeah, we can go. And so we came all the way to Vancouver, Canada. We just felt in love with the beauty. We had never seen so much green trees and so many rivers. So after that convention, our hearts stayed in Seattle. And he said, my husband said, we can move to Seattle. So we went home, sold everything, and moved to Seattle. And people will say, God, you guys are crazy. You have nobody over there. But see, people don't understand that we have a great big family. you know, wherever we go, here we are. You know, it doesn't matter. Al-Anon and AA is all over the world. And so we knew there was a big family waiting for us in Washington. And that's what happened. We moved to Washington into this one-bedroom apartment after we had the big house. And I went to a meeting, and I knew I needed to get busy with service. I knew it. You know, I didn't want to lose it. And so I went to the Al-Anon intergroup office, and I said, do you have anything for me to do? And he said, well, you know, we do. I give him my qualifications. I've been in service. I've done this, ABC. And they said, well, just keep coming back, dear. So I'm like, okay, so I'll keep coming back. And there was no Al-Anon meetings in Spanish, so I started Al-Anon meetings in Spanish. There was not enough Al-Latin, so I started another Al-Latin meeting. And we were just busy. And you know, my husband, there was only one AA meeting in Seattle that met once a week. So my husband got busy. And, you know, I talk about his gravity to people that he had when he was drinking. Now that he's in recovery, you know, a lot of people follow him. So he started this great group, and then once there was a lot of members, everybody involved in service, he moves to another group and does the same thing. He's got this attraction, and people just follow him. And so anyways, now we were both involved in service. Here's the happy family, and one day, you know, our daughter started looking like there was something wrong with her. You know, she was super thin. She wasn't the beautiful teenager that she once was. And although she was very involved in service, I couldn't understand what was going on with her. She was speaking for Al-Latin, but she was coming home with bruises on her body, on her arms. And then I, you know, we found out that she was now drinking. You know, she was drinking. And I was so mad. I was so mad at God, you know. And I yelled at him. I go, how dare you? How dare you give me an alcoholic daughter after all the service work I have done? You know? So I called my sponsor, and I said, my daughter's drinking. And Rob said, well, Magdalena, you know, maybe God wants your daughter to learn something. You know, it's not all about you. God loves alcoholics too. And see, I think it's all about me. You know, it's all the attention is on me. And so that's when my daughter's journey to treatments began. You know, she went to one treatment, she came out and relapsed, went to another, relapsed. And bad things happen to teenagers when they're out on the streets. But she didn't want to stay sober, and we still had that one little kid in the house. And so we had to ask her to leave because she was, you know, a tradition one, states unity. And we love this kid. You know, my husband and I love our daughter, but she didn't want to be part of our family anymore. And we had to ask her to leave because she was telling our son, if you don't drink with me, you're not a man. So he would start drinking with her because he wanted to be accepted by his sister. And so we had to ask her to leave. And I remember, you know, I was in so much pain and you know, crying. I would go to meetings where nobody knew me, so I could just cry and cry away. They would think I was a newcomer. And it was painful to reveal to my friends that my daughter was drinking, and so I learned in Al-Anon, and there's always room for all of us, you know, so it would have been okay for me to tell my friends. But see, when I came to Al-Anon, I never planned my kids to be alcoholics. See, I thought my daughter's going to graduate into Al-Anon, and so will my son, and no, of course, that's not what happened. So when my daughter started drinking, I didn't know what to do because since I had not planned that she was going to be an alcoholic, I, you know, take what you like and leave the rest. But when mothers will start talking about their daughters or kids, I just shut it off because that wasn't, you know. So my sponsor told me, Magdalena, you go to every meeting like it's the first meeting in your life. go with an open mind. And so I started going with an open mind. I also, you know, at the beginning, I used to go to a lot of meetings every day, all the time, and not take care of my kids. And one day I asked Ralph, I said, Ralph, how many meetings should I go to? I just don't want to miss anything. And he said, well, Magdalena, one meeting a week is visiting. Okay. So two meetings a week is maintenance. Three or more are growth. So today I go to three or more because I never want to forget that I need you guys. I need you in my life. And so one day my daughter, you know, we thought we were going to lose her. And because she knew all the right words to tell the counselors. She's grown up in the program. She's this beautiful kid that knows all the principles of the program. And one day she came home after she had been missing. I remember I was working out at Denny's restaurant as a waitress. I had been a housekeeper, a maid, a farm worker, factory worker, everything. And one day I was so tired, I was full of grease, and I came home and I got on my knees and said, God, how much longer do I need to do this kind of work? And I remember my sponsor telling me, Magdalena, without an education, you're not going to do anything in life. You're going to continue to get what you've been getting. And I told Ralph, but Ralph, I'm stupid. Remember, he said, no, you're not. You need to get educated. So I went to school while my daughter was missing in action. And I called, one day I called my sponsor and I said, I have finals today and I don't know where my daughter is. I just want to go look for her. And I also learned that I can put my loved ones in the hands of God. And I knew that my daughter would, I had turned her over to God. And I knew that my daughter was going to be okay because I trusted that God was going to take care of her. And so I didn't know where she was, and I wanted to relapse, go look for her. Where is she? But I called my sponsor instead, and he said, Magdalena, go to school, and if your daughter ever decides to come back, she'll find an educated mother. And so I went to school. And in 1999, I graduated with a 4-year college degree. And today, I am a dedicated woman. Thanks to the trust of my sponsor in following this program. And so my daughter, one day, she came home and there was this skinny kid, and she comes home and she looks at me and she said, Mom, can you take me to treatment? And I said, no, don't go to treatment. I said, you go to AA, work the steps, get a sponsor, and you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay because I trust Alcoholics Anonymous. I know the program works. You have saved my life. And, with the principles of the program, you have saved my husband's life. And I know that Alcoholics Anonymous works. And she looked at me and she had, she was drunk and she smelled just like my dad, the alcoholic breath that I so much hated on my dad, my daughter had it. And she looked at me and she said, Mom, don't you understand I can't stop drinking? It's like, how can she not stop drinking? It doesn't matter how long I've been in the program. It's hard for me to understand the disease of alcoholism. And so on that day, my husband and I, decided to take her to a treatment center, and we took her to Spokane, which is about 6 hours away. It was on a snowy day. And I remember, we thought of her as our little girl, and we wrapped her in a blanket and put her in the back of the seat of the car. Same thing with our son, and we took her to treatment. And she was in the hands of God and in the treatment center. In the treatment center, they took her to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, a Native American meeting, and they needed a coffee person. And so she became the coffee person. And today, by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, she's been sober for 15 years. And I am just so grateful. So grateful to members of Alcoholics Anonymous and for their service. Because, see, in a snowy day, this person decided to leave his family or her family and open the door so my daughter could walk in and have a meeting. Today, my son thinks that because 10 years of Alatine is enough for him, so he's cured, he's well, you know. And that's okay, because he has the principles of the program. I know he does. He talks to me and he talks program. Even though he's drinking, I'm not worried about him because he is in the hands of God. And I know that if we continue to do service in Alcoholics Anonymous in Al-Anon, if he ever wants to stay sober, I know that group of Alcoholics Anonymous will be ready for him, you know, when he's ready. And, you know, he's in the hands of God. When he was 15 years old, he had a girlfriend. He was in high school, and he had him and his girlfriend got a cat, you know. And then they broke up, and he gained custody of the cat. And I hate cats, you know. I don't like cats. Don't get close to me. And so one day I was having an Al-Anon relapse, you know, and I was looking at his room to make sure it was clean, you know. And when it wasn't clean, you know, I wrote him a nasty note saying, if you don't clean your room, I'm going to throw your cat away. And, you know, he's 15 years old. You know, it's his room. Tradition 10 talks about an outside issue. That's an outside issue. It's his room, you know. So he wrote me another note, nasty note back, and said, Mom, I'm cleaning my room one day at a time. So, I'm not all the way done yet. You know? He put that triangle with that circle. He put AA Al-Anon. And he said, he put, keep coming back, it works. So, P.S. in Spanish, leave my cat alone. So when he went to the university, I got stuck taking care of that cat, you know. That cat's still around, you know, but I kind of introduced him to the outside. And so he likes the wild, so he's a happy cat, you know. Today my son has a great job. He graduated from the university. He travels all over the world. He loves his life. He trusts that wherever he goes, he's going to be okay because, you know, recovery is also contagious. So he's a happy guy. My daughter got married to the guy of her dreams. Unfortunately, he relapsed, and they're not together anymore, but I have a beautiful granddaughter. You know, she's just so gorgeous. And when I look at her, you know, I see the miracle of the program because, see, when they were young, I just wanted to kill them, kill myself and kill my kids. I didn't know that there was a beautiful program like this that could help me. So I am just forever grateful. When I see her, I hug her and I think of you. Today I work for the state of Washington as a parole officer. I send people to treatment and to AA. If they don't want to go, they have to face the consequences to their actions. When I became armed, I called Ralph and I said, God, Ralph, you know, my job is kind of dangerous. You know, there's an opportunity for me to become armed. What do you think? I have to pass this psychological test. And Ralph, and you know, I'm kind of crazy. And then Ralph said, well, if God wants you to have a gun, you'll have a gun. So today I'm an armed officer. I call my sisters and I go, I have a gun. And they go, is your husband going to be okay? But they're not in recovery, you know. They don't understand. One day I was at Costco with my granddaughter, and when we treat people right, they treat us back with respect. And so I saw one of the people that I supervise, and this guy came to me. He said, "Hi, Magdalena. You know, what are you doing?" I go, "Shopping." So my granddaughter goes, "Mom, who?" She calls me Abuela, Grandma. "Abuela, who is that?" I say, "Oh, somebody that I work with." "Oh, is he an officer?" I go, "No." And she said, "Who is him then?" I go, she was asking too many questions. I go, "Oh, he's a criminal. He's a criminal." And she said, oh, they let criminals. She said, well, how do criminals look like? And I said, well, gosh, they look just like your grandpa and I. And she said, oh, they let criminals in the store? So today I'm still involved in service. I am the delegate for the state of Washington. I love Al-Anon. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love all of you. Thank you so much for allowing me to share my experience, strength, and hope. And please keep coming back. Thanks.